Welcome to this limited series podcast called Teaching and Learning in a Pandemic. I'm Holly Clark with my co-host Ken Shelton, and we're looking at lessons learned and those lessons we can use to transform education in the future. So let's jump into the conversation. Welcome back to the special limited podcast called Teaching and Learning in a Pandemic. We are continuing a conversation from a prior episode, and we are jumping into standards-based grading. Nadia Razzie is joining Ken and I on this episode. And Nadia, would you like to just redefine for anyone who may not have listened to the other episode, these things happen, about what standards-based grading is?
Sure. Well, I talked a little bit on the last episode about how our school practices are so rooted in this white supremacist culture that it's moved away from simply measuring whether or not students are proficient in skills and material and has moved more toward, are they behaving correctly? Are we preparing them for what I think they're going to need in the workforce or in college, right? So standards-based grading is essentially shifting the focus back to the proficiency in this set of skills. Do they know the material? And I want to give them as many opportunities as I can to actually show me that they know the material, and that can look different for each student, right? So going back to this idea that's in the Teach Plus report, Barriers to Bridges, of meeting students where they are. And meeting students where they are is just another way of saying culturally relevant teaching, right? We cannot just teach something because that's what I'm supposed to teach. You really need to tailor your teaching to what the students know, what the students are interested in, what cultural experiences they're bringing with them into the classroom. And in the case of the pandemic, the trauma that they're bringing into the classroom. So it really is my opportunity to reimagine the way that I'm teaching and assessing the students and really focusing on what's most important.
So I want to talk about focusing on what's most important, because I love, first of all, standards-based grading. But what I have seen is that teachers take the standard, like going into the text and finding textual evidence and making that one of the standards that they're grading on, which can be what they grade on or what they're trying to find proficiency in. But I think standards-based grading is a bigger concept than that. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I have with standards-based teaching is around the word mastery. If you go look it up, you're going to see a lot of times where people are putting, are they proficient? Did they meet proficiency? Did they have mastery in something? And I really, you know, there's probably a lot of people who won't like what I say on this one, but I just have a problem with the word mastery. It's a Betsy DeVos kind of situation where I don't think it takes into account an understanding of how people learn. I am a master of nothing. I cannot master, I may be a master of ed tech and technology and pedagogy, maybe because I've spent my 10,000 hours. Right? I can't master as a fourth grader fractions. To be honest with you, I don't have those mastered right now, but I can be proficient in them. And proficiency means that I'm able to apply that knowledge to a new and novel situation. I have a transfer of knowledge. And so if we have a true understanding of what proficiency means, and maybe even not add the word mastery. I don't know. I don't want to change up something that people are trying, but I just want to put a caveat out there that I'm uncomfortable with the word mastery.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, and I am definitely I see what you mean in terms of, you know, we can't expect children to be a master of this set of standards, right, in order to pass the class or in order to be, you know, quote unquote, ready for next year. And that's kind of why I really am focusing on the improvement, really encouraging students to take feedback and say, do I know how to do this? Or is this something that I can practice? The multiple opportunities come in. I want to give students any opportunity they can to show me that they can do it. And it's, to me, it's not about mastery. It's more about, yes, I get it. I learned it, right? And in this environment, That's all I can ask from students, right? I'm not expecting my students to be a master in citing evidence from the text or
right.
from, you know, of analyzing the rhetoric of an author when they're writing an article. I see what you're saying, that, you know, you're not a master of anything. I disagree. But I think that mastery is not the goal. There's always going to be improvement. To me, it's about always learning. Like there's so much that I've learned from my students. There's so much that I've learned from teaching this material that a little older than them, right? Like, I'm not going to say how old I am, but even in my years of teaching, I'm still learning.
Yep.
So the way that our school system has been set up with grading, with assessment, with this focus on grades and AP culture and achievement and all of that kind of stuff has really taken the focus away from the learning itself. And that's what I'm concerned about, right? That's why I became a teacher, is to see students when they learn something new or they are able to engage in something that interests them, right? You know, I don't care so much that a student has an A in my class.
What if we substituted the word mastery for, okay, you are proficient enough to continue your learning in this area? You know what I mean? And one of the things that I see is, even with teachers, this mastery idea is like, well, I have my master's in English, so I don't need to continue learning. And I think we need to strip mastery out of the language in order to get where we want to go. But I'm not gonna nitpick it. And I'm sure someone right now listening is like, I don't agree with her at all. And they're like, that's not what it means, mastery.
Right. And I think that it's important to, you know, there's value in what you're saying, right? I got a master's in education 9-10 years ago. And since then, I've learned so much, right? So it's not, you know, this idea of meeting a standard or being proficient or being, you know, mastering a standard is not about, you know, this is the goal. I reached the goal, now I'm done, right? So it's definitely about shifting the perspective of what it means to learn and be engaged in education.
Right.
Well, Holly brought up an important thing that kind of augments what you're sharing here. And it is the, you know, first of all, it's the whole 10,000 hour thing, which, you know, hat tip to Malcolm Gladwell. Number one, you could do something wrong for 10,000 hours. Okay. So let's be clear on that. And I agree with you in the, you know, there's, look, both of you either are or have been at one point in your career English teachers. And so you too, I'm sure, can appreciate the nuance of language. And the whole idea around mastery, to me, which is why I'm actually in agreement with both of you, you want to have some sort of a measure, but you also want the terminology to be appropriately adaptable to the environment in which you are teaching. You know, Nadia just mentioned it, you know, mastery. Well, even Michael Jordan practiced all the way through the end of his career, arguably the greatest basketball player ever, and yet he still practiced. So this whole idea around mastery as being the end result or the finish line, I think that mindset needs to shift to you're showing the necessary degree of growth and learning at this particular time that would constitute taking the step towards whatever is next. You know, I think that standards-based grading. So here's my thing about standards-based grading. I think it's anything that excludes any sort of dominant culture influence on how you assess student learning is a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, Nadia, I'm sure, you know, you've seen it. I know Holly and I have talked about it. You know, things where students are graded on, like, for example, class participation, which is garbage to me because it's an ableist type thing, because you're basically going to reward all the extroverts and punish the introverts, even though introverts, I'm sure, have plenty to offer in a learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that excludes, you know, things that are based on a cultural hierarchy is good.
Mm-hmm.
But also when you come to the standards-based grading, you know, the whole idea is, as an educator, you know, are you able to effectively determine what is the most useful and what is the most needed at that particular time based on the subject matter you teach? I'm going to give you all an example of this. I would argue that the only math that you need to learn if you don't want to pursue a degree or a career that requires mathematical proficiency at a high level, that all you need to learn is subtraction, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, and then some degree of fractions. And that's it. Because if you think about it as an adult, if you don't work in an industry of which math is a required component for the essential functions of your job, what percentage of math is a regular part of your everyday life? Those four things. And so this whole idea around mastery and you need to do this, you need to know that, you know, so this whole idea around I'm preparing the kids for the future. No, actually you're not. You're preparing them for their present, and their present should be responsive to whatever is most needed. And then as the educator, to Nadia's point, you know, what can I do to ensure growth in my subject matter that will put you in a position for success when you move to, in Nadia's case, you know, when you go to the 10th grade or, you know, something along those lines.
I have a couple of math teacher friends who would be pretty disappointed if I didn't address that. You know, there is obviously value in learning these higher mathematical concepts. I don't teach math. Like, let's just make that clear. But, you know, obviously there's going to be value in the thinking and the critical thinking that comes with learning higher levels of math. But at the same time, I think that you do have a point in that these arbitrary kind of measures that we've become accustomed to assessing students on. So let me give you the example of late work, for example. So when I first started teaching, I marked students down 50% if they turned in something late. Now, with my expertise and the years that I've spent teaching, and this kind of goes back to the idea that, you know, mastery is not something that you achieve. It's this ongoing process of continuing to learn, right? So whereas there's value in, you know, my previous practice of, oh, like you didn't turn it in on time, you're going to get marked down, right? Because when you go to the workforce, then that's what's going to be expected of you, right? And it's really interesting to kind of sit down and pick apart these policies that we've just kind of come to think like, yeah, that's how it's supposed to be, right? And the way that I'm doing it this year and that I have been doing it for quite some time is that I understand that you turned it in late, but you still know how to do it. You still did it. And that's ultimately my goal. It's not my job necessarily to teach you to turn in things on time. I can tell you, hey, next time maybe you should try to get it turned in on time, but I'm not going to grade students on that, right? That's not what's going to go into my grading because that is not what's in the standards.
So you mentioned something, Nadia, that I really like. You said getting kids ready for next year. I hear that all the time. I try and do something unique in this eighth grade class I'm in. We're like, oh, but we're getting them ready for high school. And high school is always saying, oh, but we're getting them ready for college. I think we should just take that out and say we're getting kids ready for life. Is this getting them ready for being a good learner, for being curious, for being those things that are more important in this situation? And I wish we could all just settle down on this getting ready for what we think is next and
you know,
get them ready for life.
I'm glad we're having this discussion. So two things. One is, Nadia, I would love to have that conversation with your math teacher friends, because I would argue, and I can cite specific examples of where that is a result of a colonizer mentality. You have to, like, for example, oh, you have to take calculus because it teaches you a particular way to think. According to whose standard and what cultural context? Because I can cite specific examples of students that I had in Central and South Central LA who were doing advanced level math in middle school and didn't even realize it. But it wasn't within the context of a mathematical classroom of which the teacher determined what was acceptable in the use of math and how it was taught. It was a result of them adapting to the community and cultural context in which they were doing it. Now, I won't go into detail of some of the things that I knew some of the students were doing, but let's just say that being an entrepreneur can take on a different role depending upon the community that you're in. So you can fill in the blank there. And so that's my point with that. And again, this is middle school. So calculus isn't even offered in middle school. And yet they were doing, things that I just encouraged them, which I found out later, of course, that they actually are doing some things. I just said, look, you could apply the skills that you're using now for survival in your community in a more fruitful and beneficial capacity to you for longer term success. Now, to Holly's point, was I preparing them for their future? Not really, because I can't predict what's going to happen in the future. But what I am doing is saying, look, there are ways in which the things that you are learning can easily be transferable, and then you can adapt them into, the context of what you're currently in. And I think this whole idea around preparing kids for this quote unquote future, I reject that. That to me, and of course, it's my own opinion about it, but I think that when I hear those statements, that is, operating from a degree of ignorance, because you can't predict what's going to happen in the future. You don't know what the environment's going to be in. You know how many times I was told in high school, and especially in my AP class, I'm preparing you for college. Not a single one of those classes prepared me for any of my classes in college. What's more important is being able to adapt to the learning environment and utilize the skills that you do have, ideally, to be successful in that environment.
I will say the exact same thing, Ken. When I got to college, I was really good at school, so I expected that I would walk into college and be so good and whatever. And I almost flunked my first semester because I thought I was going to answer multiple choice questions. And I had that down. And then my teachers wanted me to think. I was at a top university where they were asking me not to regurgitate answers. And I was like, what the heck is this? I was looking at other people who were doing so well. And I'm like, what's wrong with me? So they didn't prepare me for college. I almost flunked.
Same here.
And it's interesting because this idea of, when I think about my college classes, and all of the things that my teachers, turn in your work on time and make sure, it's an MLA format and all those kinds of things that I was like, none of that went into my grade in college, right? There's a midterm and there's a final. And all it was that went into my grade was whether or not I knew the material.
And I don't even want to talk about MLA format in 2020. In a digital world, but that's a whole other show.
Well, yes, the citation format. So listen, I do have to add one quick thing here. I remember in grad school, I had to take a class. You two are going to love this. I had a class, one quarter, the class was dedicated to proper citations of your research. I had to take a whole class on that.
Sounds so fun.
And of course, back then, oh my goodness. And here's the interesting thing. Back then you had, I don't know if it still exists now, but you had a website called the Citation Machine. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, do I tell the professor that this exists or not? So going back to Holly and you, where you both were talking about something like mastery, here's an example of I have a college professor who has a doctorate, who teaches in a graduate school of education. She was a tenured professor, so obviously she had fulfilled all of whatever the requirements were to reach to be designated with tenure. So theoretically, one would say that is a professor that has reached mastery. Yet, the very subject matter you're teaching, you don't have the awareness that there is a website that all I have to do is plug in this information, and it will essentially churn out the proper formatting of APA, MLA, Chicago, all those different formatting things. And yet here I am taking a whole class on this.
Do you know that Google Docs does that for you now?
Well, it didn't back then. So I'm a little bit older than you. In fact, when I was in grad school, Google Docs didn't exist. You know what it was? It was Writely, which is what Google acquired that became Google Docs. But my main point, going back to what you two were saying and even what Holly was sharing around mastery, here's an example of a professor that theoretically, by all academic measures, is a master at what they do, yet they had no awareness of, this website. And so that's why I think, to Holly's point, ideally you want to adopt a mindset that there's no such thing as mastery. There is proficiency at this particular point in time, and then I'm going to continue to learn and continue to grow.
Yeah. And that teacher you're talking about, what was more important in citing the research is validating that research. Was that research done well? Does it mean something? And we have forgotten in this race to cite our research about the validation of it. And that's another instance of mastery failure. I'm going to coin the term.
Exactly. Now, can I add one more thing? Because Nadia brought it up, and I think it's important, you know, considering the subject matter of these podcasts and this episode. And by the way, I'm enjoying listening to the two of you as much as I enjoy talking. Nadia, you brought up the thing about time. I think it's important for the listeners to understand time is socially constructed. Okay, that's first. I'll give you an example. For me growing up, my father would say to me, when I'm playing out in the street with my friends, especially in the summer, be home by sundown. Oh, what time is sundown? And so the whole idea is that time is socially constructed and there's always a cultural lens applied to it. So to the point you made, think about for us when we were in school and even in many learning spaces now, how much emphasis and value is placed on turning it on time, beat a class on time. I remember having an argument at my last school over the fact that they wanted students to be marked tardy if they weren't in their seat with their books out when the bell rings. And I'm like, okay, so then if they are in the classroom and the bell rings, so I should mark them tardy. You see how everything is looked at in a punitive capacity rather than, okay, so let's first unpack what is the purpose of holding ourselves or students accountable based on this socially constructed dynamic. I love the fact that you just shared that if a student turns in the work late, it's like, okay, listen, part of turning it in on time, you know, like to me with the students, but like part of turning it in on time, it means that I have the ability to process what you are doing to give you feedback in a timely capacity. But you brought up the more important thing, and that is, okay, so you didn't turn it on time. I'm not going to ding you for that. I'm going to encourage you to do it on time. But now I'm going to basically grade it based on the value of the work that you did. I'm not going to take 10% off because, you know, you turned it in late.
Mm-hmm. And now, and the modern iteration of what you're talking about now is actually, I think, a little more insidious, is that we're seeing this, what you're describing is, you know, the impact of white supremacy in our schools and what, you know, how we're all being groomed to behave and exist in this world that is racist. And now what we see is, you know, the same policy, but a little different in distance learning, which is, you know, am I allowed to mark the student absent if they don't turn their camera on? Or am I allowed to not give them credit if they type in the chat instead of say it out loud, right? There were some policies coming out in the beginning of the year that they were saying, you know, you must be dressed for school, you must be out of bed. And I really pushed back to all these policies and said, for what? How does that, why is that, first of all, my job to police what children are doing in their own homes, right? And then also, what does that have to do with the subject I'm teaching? I don't care if you're in bed. I don't care if, I mean, you know, it is hard, and I can see what some teachers are saying, because it is more difficult to engage in a class of students with all their cameras off. I get that. But at the same time, you don't know what that student is dealing with at home. You don't know if they have a designated workspace to do their work. You don't know if they have their family there, or what they're dealing with, or if they have to work. Are they calling into class from work on their phone, right? So there's all these things that that teachers are really pushing for, like I said, kind of business as usual, trying to make it look as much like quote unquote normal school as possible. And this isn't normal. We're in a pandemic, and all of those inequities and all of the issues that our vulnerable students have always been facing are now exacerbated because of a pandemic. And now is not the time to, you know, kind of double down on these expectations. And it really comes back to what I was saying about meeting students where they are and that culturally relevant teaching. And I'm not going to grade you on things that aren't important right now. And over right. the summer, I heard
thank you for being
Yamil
here.
Baez speak, and she said, grading during a pandemic is violence. And that really stuck with me. And I really have been thinking about that all year, about what harm are we doing to these students who are probably depressed and anxious and overwhelmed? The majority of our students are depressed and anxious and overwhelmed. And also, so are the majority of our teachers.
That's right.
And to keep going as if, this is business as usual, this is how I've always done it, is so harmful, not only to ourselves, but especially to our students, especially for our most vulnerable students who don't have the resources right now. We haven't even talked about the obvious inequities of distance learning, for example, access to technology or access to reliable internet. These students have to turn their camera off, otherwise they won't be able to hear what the teacher's saying, right? So there's so many obvious and also covert and kind of insidious implications of these expectations that we have for students, and I don't think that any of us are prepared for whenever we do come back to campus, how traumatized these students and teachers and counselors are going
and,
to be.
And superintendents.
Right. I mean,
let's not forget, but and I know we're going to have to conclude. I want to mention or share a couple of things. One is I remember a couple of weeks ago, I had chimed in on a post on Twitter, because someone had posted that, essentially there were a group of teachers that, were given consent by, I don't know if it was the superintendent, the school board, or the site administrator, that they can fail students, and they celebrated it. And so then I posted, which was interesting. I need to do a blog posting on this, which I'd love to actually co-author it with the two of you. No pressure. Because ultimately my response to that was, if failing students is your jam, then you need to accept the fact that you condone abusive learning environments and you really should resign. And the whole idea around that, to your point, Nadia, is that no teacher should derive any degree of pleasure from failing a student. Okay. When I look at students that have flunked out of school, I don't look at it as a student flunked out. I look at it as a school and the system failed that student because some sort of need, resource, or support was not met. And so, the whole idea, like what you're sharing around, you have to dress a certain way, it's all that compliance and conformity garbage. That has nothing to do with learning. What that is that's a byproduct of, like you said, one, what does a dominant culture deem to be appropriate, and how do we capitalize or exploit those in the environment by being compliant and conforming to what we want? Because that's the future we want to prepare you for. We don't want you to be a critical, independent thinker. We don't want you to go against the status quo. We don't want you to understand what social justice is. We want you to be another cog in the wheel of the status quo. That's what all that is.
And on top of all of this, as we end this session, is we're talking about that there's all this trauma going on and there's all of this new things happening and we don't really understand what's going on behind the camera. And then on top of that, we don't read the room enough to not say learning loss. You know what? 1 year has never hurt anybody. 1 year has never held us back. So I just caution again, and we have two episodes on learning loss, and people might disagree with our take on it. Any final thoughts?
I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to spend this time with the both of you. It's been an enjoyable conversation and has provoked a lot of thought for me as well, because I don't believe in mastery. I'm still learning.
I always love talking to you too. I think that you're going to blow a lot of people's minds with some of these ideas, but I think that that's probably going to be a takeaway. A main takeaway is that our goal shouldn't be mastery. It's always been my goal in education to empower students to think for themselves, to continue learning. And even, a student told me yesterday, you're an adult, you're supposed to know everything. And I said, I've never claimed to know everything, right? I'm still learning. I'm learning so much from my students. I'm learning so much from the material the discussions that we're having. I think that we should be fostering that kind of curiosity and lifelong learning, and not just saying, you need to learn the way that I've always taught.
And thank you. Yes, Nadia, we learned a lot from you as well. We always do. That's why we asked you to be on this. And we'll see everyone in the other episodes. And thank you. We hope that there's been some provoking of thinking happening today.
Bye. Thank you.
We want to take a moment and say thank you to our sponsor, Book Creator. Book Creator is an incredible app to use in a blended learning classroom as it allows students to do more than create books, but interact with their learning. Check them out at app.bookcreator.com. It's definitely one of my favorite applications for teaching and learning in the classroom. Teaching and learning in the pandemic has definitely made us rethink what assessment should look like in the digital age. For more help, download your free assessment toolkit at infuse.link/podcast. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Teaching and Learning in a Pandemic. This is a limited series that will disappear in early 2021, so make sure to listen to all the episodes before they're gone.